This episode of The Orb is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 150,000 titles for your desktop or mobile device. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. Also, help us keep Star Trek discussion coming to you each day by becoming a Trek FM patron through Patreon. Get access to exclusive content and become part of the team. You'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm.
This is J.G. Hertz, the General Martok on Deep Space Nine, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome, Niners, to another episode of The Orb, our dedicated Deep Space Nine show. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me, as he always is my esteemed co-host, Matthew Rushing. Matthew, I told you which uniforms we were going to wear today, and I see that you've worn something different. What's going on?
Well, Chris, we have two different types of uniforms. I just picked whichever one was clean, but there wasn't any regulations that I thought of that we had to wear, you know, one specific uniform or the other. This jumpsuit's just so comfy.
I see. Well, I like the more formal look that I'm wearing right here. So are you telling me that what happened in Star Trek Generations is that half of the crew had one of their uniform styles in the laundry and they just grabbed the other one?
Well, I think that's exactly what happened, Chris, because there's actually no rhyme or reason for why certain characters are wearing a certain uniform at a certain time, other than one got dirty and they went to their closet and, oh, wait, I only have the jumpsuit. Oh, wait, I only have the one with the shirt that's going to require the Picard maneuver.
All right. Okay, well, that makes a lot of sense to me. So, why are we talking about Generations, everyone? Well, today we're going to start a new four-part series focused on Worf, specifically Worf's journey to Deep Space Nine. So this is going to be a different sort of orb in that we're going to talk a lot of the Next Generation today. But the purpose is to see how the story following TNG led Worf to DS9. So how did his story lead from one to the other? And then, of course, because First Contact and Insurrection take place alongside the events of DS9, we'll talk about how his experience with both influenced the character during that time. And finally, there's Nemesis, which takes place a full 4 years after What You Leave Behind, 2379 versus 2375. So we're going to touch on a lot of different time periods in Worf's life. But the first one, of course, is going to be Generations.
Which is exciting, Chris. You know, one, it's been a long time since I've watched through all the Next Generation films. And I love the focus that we thought of as a way to be able to talk about these films because, you know, Worf, it's very interesting, the character growth that happens through, you know, Deep Space Nine. And so the idea of does any of that get carried over to when he is in the films, I think is an interesting question. Especially since so much happens to him. So by the time he is in First Contact, by the time he's in Insurrection, and then by the time he's in Nemesis, I mean, he's had almost a whole other life.
Yeah.
And a whole lifetime type of experiences without those characters in his life. So it creates some really interesting questions and some new ways to try and view the Next Generation films from his point of view.
Yeah, very much so. So let's start a little bit before Generations, though, and talk about the final days of TNG to lead us into Generations. Obviously, there's not a lot for Worf to do in Generations, so we're going to roll back a little bit more. And as the Next Generation came to a close, we saw a few new developments in Worf's character. Of course, at the point when they were writing that, they had no idea that he was going to make the leap to DS9. So you can view those character developments in two ways. You can either see them as self-contained within TNG or very late in season seven, just dead ends that they're throwing in there at the end of a series. Or you can look at them as a setup for things to come. And we're going to do more of the latter, since the purpose of the series is to follow Worf from TNG to DS9. So Matthew, I was looking for some key moments in season seven. And the one that stands out to me first is, of course, his relationship with Deanna, which fans absolutely love. But it came there towards the end of season seven. How do you think that played in, though, to his transition to DS9 and then later on his relationship with Jadzia?
Well, it's a really interesting thing. It actually reminds me most of what happened to Seven and Chakotay in Voyager, that just in the middle of season seven, all of the sudden there's this romance between these two characters, like three episodes from the end that really had never
been hinted at prior, right?
Right.
Yeah.
And what's interesting about the TNG romance between Deanna and Worf is that really kind of in the middle of them is Alexander and her helping him with this son that he's struggling to raise. And through that, they kind of, it really seems like it's through that that the relationship kind of blossoms into something, would we say romantic? I mean, other than having a mud bath with Alexander and Luxana and Troy and Worf all at the same time, I don't know. It's a strange coupling.
It is. I think there was a bit of romance there. I think at least Michael Dorn and Marina Sirtis played it that way. But it was such a flash at the end of the series, just pulled out of nowhere. And when I look at it, sometimes I think of it as being put there to set up the disagreement between Riker and Worf in the future time frame in All Good Things. But I don't know that that's actually what was going on, because they start this little relationship earlier on, right? Mm-hmm. So I don't know that they were actually thinking ahead to what they were going to do with the finale and the fact that they would need to have Riker and Worf at odds with each other. I think that was just put in because it made sense based on the fact that Worf and Deanna had this relationship going. So you can read a lot into it if you want to and kind of flesh it out in your own head canon as to what's going on there. But I think the point about Alexander is good. And it also plays in a bit to the family element of Worf. And he was really a loner throughout TNG. So the fact that he warmed up to somebody and had some kind of relationship with a woman this way, I think we can look at it and see it as preparing him a bit to be at least more open to Jadzia when he finally meets her. And of course, we know moving forward, just before Jadzia is killed, they were actually going to start a family together. And that's something that I think after Worf's experiences with Alexander, I don't know that that's something he would really jump to do.
It's a really interesting thing, the thought of, you know, Worf with Deanna. And what's weird is that when you get to Generations, it's just gone. Like, you know, there's absolutely nothing there. There's no reference to it whatsoever.
Well, remember at the end of All Good Things, they agreed to not let certain things happen.
True, true. And it was just a strange thing, because it just feels like it comes out of left field. And then, of course, it really, I don't know what consequence it has, other than it did seem to help with his relationship with Alexander at the time. But then, of course, once we get to Deep Space Nine, that relationships get soured again. And maybe that's because Deanna wasn't around. I'm not sure. And so, I don't know. It's just odd. And I wish that they had maybe given it more time on screen, because, you know, like you said, Michael Dorn and Marina Sirtis are such good friends, and it could have been, you know, something that worked really well on screen if they had actually given it a little bit more thought on the show and how to integrate that kind of big thing. Because when you think about this too, it's really, other than Troy and Riker and the captain and Crusher, this is really the only time that we're seeing two crew members on TNG get together. I mean, Data and Yar hooking up, it doesn't really count.
I was going to say Data and Geordi. You don't consider Data and
them
Geordi
a couple. I mean, that's close. But, you know, this was really interesting because if you think about it this way, maybe this gave them the push for when they get to Deep Space Nine to allow more characters to start getting together.
Yeah, maybe.
So I don't know, because it's the first time it really happened on TNG, and they gave it a go. And then, of course, Deep Space Nine, like, lots of people start coupling up because, well, that's kind of what happens in life, you know?
Yeah. Well, and on DS9, they start coupling up later because we do have the overlap where we have TNG and DS9 running at the same time. And so when this happens with Worf and Deanna on TNG, DS9's already going. So it's not like this happened and then they developed DS9. But at the same time, we don't see that coupling up in the early seasons of DS9, right? It starts to come later on in the series. So you could be right that this sort of opened up those doors a little bit.
So then we really actually have something to be thankful for Worf and Deanna hooking up for a while.
Yeah, maybe so. All right, let's touch on a couple of other season 7 moments here real quick. You mentioned Alexander. There's the episode Firstborn, where Alexander comes back from the future, and then he wants Worf to train him when he's young so that he can fight because he wants to be able to help his father in the future. And then we see Worf working with Alexander, teaching him how to use a batleth and all of these things. And in terms of it playing in... Oh, and Quark is in that episode as well. He appears on screen anyway. And so playing into the relationships that we see with Worf and Alexander in DS9 in the future, do you see any seeds planted here on TNG that help bridge that and carry us forward into DS9?
Well, it's very interesting that, you know, the next time we're going to see Alexander, you know, he is going to be somebody who apparently really never did learn to fight. There's some kind of falling out that happens between Worf and his son, because Worf sends his son to live with his grandparents. And, you know, once the war starts, then Alexander joins the defense force of the Klingon Navy. And it's just very interesting because there's a lot of story that happens between them off screen. And it's interesting that it gets left here in Firstborn as this thing where they're closer. You know, Alexander's saying he wants to be more Klingon and all that. And then the next time we see him, apparently he's the world's worst Klingon.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
And can't use a batleth, is the laughingstock of his ship. And so it was ripe for more stories to be told, but they never picked it up. So that's an interesting thing because it actually kind of creates this strange disconnect between TNG and Alexander and Worf with what we get in Deep Space Nine with Alexander and Worf.
Yeah. I just find it interesting in, you know, as a father and thinking about what you're going to teach your children, what you're going to teach your son. And then in the future, when you look back at what you did or you did not do and how that affects how you see yourself and the relationship that you have with your children later on, I think that you could connect these episodes a bit and just kind of follow Worf's story there. And like you said, when we see Alexander trying to fit in with Klingons later on in DS9 and it really doesn't work out, you know, Worf may have regrets looking back.
Well, it's interesting because at that point, like father, like son, Worf has not always been the best at connecting with Klingons either.
Right.
So it's very interesting. And I think that's one of the reasons that, you know, Worf and Alexander had so many problems is Worf maybe saw too much of a reflection of himself and his son, and it made him self-conscious. You know, it made him feel bad about himself and the fact that he wasn't a better Klingon to be able to teach his son how to be a better Klingon. You know, there's maybe some shame that goes along there too. So it does really create this very interesting storyline and gives you some interesting thoughts to kind of create a headcanon of what would have happened between those two, between what we see in Firstborn till the next time we see them on Deep Space Nine to leave them that way.
Yeah. Do you think that Worf looking at Alexander and wishing that his son were more receptive to him and to learning more about his Klingon heritage played any role in Worf being willing to let Martok take him under his wing and for Worf to learn more about what it means to be a real Klingon from Martok?
Oh, definitely. I think that, you know, there's a real father-son thing going on in that whole storyline with Worf, and he's always been looking for somebody to teach him how to be a real Klingon, and I think it speaks to the idea of manhood, and manhood is passed on by a man to a boy. You know, a boy can't just teach himself how to be a man. He needs a good role model to do that, and that's why strong male figures in boys' lives are so important, whether it's a father or an uncle or grandfather, somebody there to help pass on that experience of what it truly means to be a man. And Worf, I think, very much has struggled with that in the sense of, for him, the manhood of Klingonhood and not figuring that out. And finally, you know, Martok is this rough and tumble, you know, he's kind of from, I kind of think as Martok is the Klingon who's from the Midwest, you know, of the Klingon Empire, where he is just down home. He tells it like it is, and he is the Klingon of Klingons, and Worf finally finds that. And I think through Deep Space Nine, at the same time, Martok also helps Worf become comfortable with the fact that he's like Spock. I am unique. I am Klingon, mm-hmm. I am human, I am both, and I'm okay with being myself. And that actually makes him okay with his son then, for his son being himself. So it's a really cool and deep and interesting storyline when you're thinking about this. And yeah, I think in some strange way, as I said, there's a disconnect, but it also Firstborn helps give us some good storylines to come in Deep Space Nine with Alexander, which, when it came to Alexander and TNG, I don't think I ever would have said I would have been excited to see that character again. So,
right. And it is true that Worf is part Klingon and part human. Even though he's full-blooded Klingon, he grew up on Earth. He grew up with humans. And when you grow up in another culture that's different from your own, or even when you live in another culture that's different from your own, as I have for almost my whole adult life, you really do become part of that culture, even though you're not right. That culture by blood. And so in the case of Worf, I think that's true, what you say. So the other one that let's talk about for a moment is his relationship with his brother in Homeward in season 7. We see that come into play. It kind of plays into the family dynamic, maybe in a little bit of what we're talking about right now with his parents and growing up on Earth, and then he encounters his brother again. Does that maybe play into the sense of family, his ability to work with the crew, his loyalty to others, anything like that that you see there?
I think that it is another interesting testing of Worf and his devotion to Starfleet and his ideals as a Starfleet officer and a Klingon and honor, family, all of these things. And it's a good way to kind of see that test one more time before we actually will lead into where he's going to be when he comes on to Deep Space Nine the first time, where again, his loyalties between the Klingon Empire and the Federation and Starfleet are all being tested, which leave Worf in the way of the warrior feeling like, I'm done. I'm done with all of this. I'm just done with it. You know, I'm going to go be on a Maserite freighter. And, you know, I don't want to do any of this anymore. And so it is an interesting storyline that actually will get kind of picked up again in Deep Space Nine subtly and lead us to that character and the kind of Worf's kind of in an emotional malaise once he comes to Deep Space Nine for a lot of reasons. Yeah. And I think season 7, strangely enough, of TNG, and what happens in Generations leads him to being in that place we get him. And well done writing on the Deep Space Nine staff to use a lot of that if you've been paying attention or if you were watching it. You remember season 7 of TNG and what happened in Generations. Kind of made sense that Worf came on and he was just kind of He was a lot like Sisko when he came to Deep Space Nine. He didn't want to be there. And, you know, which made, again, for another great storyline, because Sisko had already been through that. And Sisko kind of mentors Worf at that point. So, again, such great things happen here. And the use of continuity, the loose continuity of TNG, really, again, got picked up in Deep Space Nine, and they just ran with it, as they did with everything they did in Deep Space Nine.
Yeah, exactly. Well, let's talk about Generations a bit. Let's move on into the movie now. So in the first TNG film, we see Worf being promoted to Lieutenant Commander, and the rank, of course, has nothing really to do with him moving forward to DS9, and he's still on the operations track at that point as well. But the promotion, what it means to me is that he received this promotion, I think a long overdue promotion, as most of the characters on Star Trek have long overdue promotions. He received this because of his dedication and his loyalty. Not only did Picard see that, but everyone on the crew saw that. I mean, Worf marched to the beat of his own drum, for sure. But he's someone that I think everyone knows they can depend on. He's always got your back. He's going to protect you. He's very loyal. And that goes on his record, of course, but also word gets around, word of mouth. Do you see this in any way playing into him coming to Sisko's attention? And I mean, we have to step out of universe, well, not out of universe, but we have to step out of our fans' view and the obvious view that, well, they wanted a character from the Next Generation and they got Michael Dorn, and that's why we got Worf on Deep Space Nine. So let's step out of that for a minute and keep it from the point of view of the characters living in that universe. Sisko needs someone. He calls upon Worf. He's reviewed records. He's talked to people. He's probably even talked to Picard, and he calls upon Worf.
Well, I think, you know, if you're thinking like Sisko, next to Jadzia, who's on your station and was linked with the great Curzon Dax, who has more experience with negotiating with Klingons than anybody, you have Picard and Worf, who have been instrumental in all that's happened with the Klingons over the last, you know, 10 years. And so when you're not going to get Picard to come.
Well,
but,
sure. Well, you don't need Picard either in this situation.
But you could get not only somebody who is a Klingon himself, but somebody who has intimate knowledge of the people involved. You know, Martok, Gowron, who he helped put in office, you know, through devious means and a lie and all that. But that gives you a whole leg up as Sisko. And it, you know, we kind of said, oh, you have to put on your the other hat, but you know, I'm not sure who else he would choose because of the qualifications that Worf does have for the job. And yes, I think looking at his service record on the Enterprise, it's exemplary for the most part. Mm-hmm. And I think any recommendation that would have come from Picard would have been nothing but glowing. And like you said, he just got promoted for Lieutenant Commander in this film before he goes to Deep Space Nine because he's an exemplary officer and deserves to be at a higher rank. So all those things are working in his favor as Sisko is probably looking at the very short list of candidates who could help him with this Klingon problem.
Well, if there's one person who would not be particularly fond of a glowing endorsement from Picard, it would be Sisko, right?
You know, that could be the case, but I also think that Sisko was able to put that to bed. You know,
yeah, I think by the time we get to Way of the Warrior, he's over that. So.
Oh, definitely. And I think, you know, Sisko at that point had been through enough things to realize that his anger was misplaced. And yeah. I always have kind of, in the back of my mind, seen Sisko maybe writing a letter to Picard to apologize and
maybe he dictated a letter to Jake.
That could
Since
have been
Jake's
the case. Yeah,
writer.
That's true. Jake,
he's
you
like,
embellished
Jake,
this.
Take these thoughts and make them sound good.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
Send that off to Picard for me.
But I could definitely see that, you know, so And, you know, whether he loves Picard, Picard is the captain of the flagship of the fleet, and therefore, you know, it's hard not to have even just begrudging respect for somebody like that. But I think that at that point they had patched things up. For
yeah,
sure.
I think so,
because Picard obviously had no ill will against Sisko.
Oh,
it was
sure.
all coming from Sisko, and once that was gone, I think that they would have been cordial, if not good acquaintances by that point. Because you know, at that point, Sisko had had a pretty big impact, you know, with everything that happened in Homefront and things like that. So I think he would have been on Picard's radar as well. So,
yeah, exactly. All right. So that's the promotion. Another thing I see in Generations is that we just continue Worf's balance between his Starfleet duty and his Klingon heritage. And there's not much in the movie because obviously it's a movie about Captain Kirk and Captain Picard primarily, and then Data.
Yeah, I was supposed to say, and Data.
There, and Data. It's not a movie about Worf or Geordi, a little bit more about Geordi, but it's not Worf, Troy, you know, these characters so much. So Worf does not get to do very much here. But it is Worf's knowledge of Klingon ship design that allows the crew to ultimately survive, even though they do get killed once, and then that gets reset by the events of what happens after Picard and Kirk come back from the Nexus. So this is another case where Worf knows these things about the Klingons because he's a Klingon and he studies his heritage and he studies... I picture him like studying everything he can get his hands on that's Klingon related. That's kind of how I picture Worf in TNG.
I always pictured that behind one of the secret panels that, you know, you would open it up and there would be like, you know how, well, Chris, you can see my office. It's full of collectibles, but that he would have like Klingon collectibles, you know, in the secret compartment that he could open up when only he was in his quarters that nobody else knew about.
That's
you
right.
know, he's got like his Mighty Cracks Klingon action figure and things like that. I just made that up, by the way. But no, I think it is. I could see Worf being like Scotty, where, you know, Scotty was always with the technical manuals for the Enterprise and design. I could see, you know, Worf's way of relaxing would to be to read the history of this and so part of the Empire, or, you know, to be listening to a Klingon opera, or, you know, all of those kind of things, that's what he spends his time doing.
Yeah.
And, you know, this movie also furthers his hatred of the Romulans, because when they go to the Amargosa Observatory and they find out that it was a Romulan, he has the great line, "Romulan."
I know, like, that's the whole line, but the way he says just, it.
Yeah, you could tell he's like not happy. He's pissed.
There's so much disgust in that one word about the Romulans. Now, you could argue that because he is the tactical officer, he is going to know these things about enemy ships. You know, what type of coils they're using, how their engines work, how their defensive systems work. And I think that's true. But I also think that he probably has more specific knowledge about Klingon technology than the average Starfleet technical officer would have because of his heritage.
Yeah.
And his interest in it.
And it's, I think it goes both ways. And I think it's a nice moment for Worf that, you know, Riker immediately turns to Worf, his tactical officer, and says, "What do we know about that old Klingon ship?" You know, and Worf is able to spout off everything he knows about it. How could we use that? And, you know, it's a very tiny moment, but it is a great moment for Worf that he's good at his job and he's trusted by those around him. And he's not just the guy that everybody says no to anymore. You know, he's somebody that, I mean, he just got promoted to lieutenant commander. He deserves to be there with all of these other characters. And so that's a really, it's a nice moment for the character. And I think it sets him up moving to Deep Space Nine, because he is going to prove himself once again to be worthy of learning a whole new part of the Starfleet trade, which is to be on the command track and not just the security track. And he struggles with that a little bit, but Sisko really kind of nurtures him into that. And so it just, it shows you, I think, that the character is good at his job, but he can always do more. He can learn more. And yeah, so I really like that.
Yeah. And the other connection I see there too is that when he does come to DS9 in Way of the Warrior, and we talked about why Sisko would have chosen him, but another element here is that, again, he's not being chosen just because he's a Klingon, just because he's a Klingon in Starfleet, but he also has the knowledge that's necessary on a factual level, like understanding things about the Empire in the moment that's necessary to do that job. So it is one element here, even though it's a brief moment in the movie.
Yeah.
Because again, there's not a lot to draw upon here in Generations for Worf, but it ties in.
Well, Chris, one of the biggest things I think that comes out of the film is, you know, Worf is always a character who, as we've talked about, this Starfleet duty, Klingon heritage, being raised by humans, he's always felt out of place. And Generations leaves Worf homeless, you know. It's almost as if homeless Klingon searches for new home. You know, he lost the place that he felt most at home, the Enterprise D. And they use that in Way of the Warrior so that when Worf comes to Deep Space Nine, you know, him and O'Brien have a quick conversation about, you know, sorry to hear about the Enterprise and, you know, she was a good ship. And but it's more than that. So all of those things that we talked about earlier, that the experiences that he had on the Enterprise, especially through season 7, the loss of the Enterprise D, and the frustrations that are happening with the Klingon Empire now with the Federation, leave him feeling completely disenfranchised. And he feels, I think at this point, there's such a melancholy about him, and he feels kind of hopeless. And I think that really is compounded by the fact that he just lost the place that he felt most at home and is not sure if that will ever be where he'll be again or if he'll find that again.
Because where would he go? He's not going to go back to Earth, and he can't go back to Kronos.
Right.
Yeah. That's a good point. You know, the Enterprise would have been destroyed regardless in Generations. That was part of the story. They wanted to make a new ship. So destroying the Enterprise has nothing at all to do with Worf's character arc. But the fact that it is destroyed, like you said, that's a great point. It does open up this door. Whereas if the Enterprise D had not been destroyed in that movie, I'm not sure that, I mean, how would they have brought Worf on? I mean, they could bring him on. You could just make up something and say, yeah, it's such an attractive post that he's going to transfer. But I feel like it would have been a hard sell, right? Because he's comfortable with that crew. Like you said, that's his home. He respects Picard as a captain. He probably is not going to so easily decide to go to this other place and step into the fray in the middle of a conflict between the Federation and the Klingon Empire, because it really does put him at odds with himself, right?
Right. Well, and there is a sense that obviously with the Enterprise D being destroyed, it makes it work much better. But we have to remember, you know, Starfleet is a military organization as much as it is exploration. And if you're ordered to go to a new post, that's where you go. You don't have a choice in it. Actually, that's what happens to Worf. He has to report to Deep Space Nine. He's to report to Captain Sisko. And he is to be the liaison officer with everything that's going on with the Klingons. And he doesn't want that job. You know, and that's why he's considering leaving his commission and going on a Maserite freighter to do whatever that means.
But do you think if he were still on the Enterprise with Picard, he could have then gone to Picard and said, look, I really don't want to do this. I really want to stay here with you. And then Picard would have told Starfleet, you can't take my tactical officer away from me. I need him here.
I see Picard being too much a stickler for the rules and being like, I'm sorry, Mr. Worf, but we need you there. And he would have talked him into it. So I just, from what I know of Picard,
And then do you think that Worf would have dramatically taken the pips off his collar and put them on Picard's desk?
Oh, yes.
And said, I'm going to go with the Maserites.
That's right. No, I think Worf has too much respect for somebody like Picard. And Worf has too much respect for the chain of command. You know, he's a Klingon. It would not be honorable to not fulfill the duty which he had signed up for. That's why after his assignment at Deep Space Nine, he was going to resign after that. And so, you know, in the way of the warrior, it becomes about him trying to decide, is he really going to go through with that or will he stay? And of course, we know he stays. But all of that, I think, is just really cool that it leads to a place unexpectedly for the writers. They had no intention of doing that. But it really does work to their advantage. It's a really nice bit of felicitous writing to just make that all come together.
Yeah, good point. So with Worf, there's one thing that's not Worf-related that I want to chat about for a moment here about Generations. But before we do that, are there any other moments with Worf in Generations that you want to tie into DS9?
Goodness. You know, it is kind of sad that Worf never gets to meet Kirk, you know? So, other than that, you know, I wish that, and this is related to Worf and the rest of the TNG cast, I wish that the TNG films had been more ensemble related and not pandered so much to Brett Spiner, that really cut out the rest of the crew from the films for the most part. So, because I would have loved to have seen a bigger part for them.
Yeah, but that's just how films go. Like if we had a DS9 film, it's quite possible that the DS9 film would have been all about Sisko and maybe all about Worf, for example.
Yeah, you're right. Films are a much different beast, that's for sure. So it is just disappointing that... we'll talk about First Contact, but I definitely think Worf has a lot more to do in that film and a lot more substantial role in that film than anything else that he gets in any of the other films. Waking up with a gorch is...
Well, you know, I was going to say he gets a giant zit later on, Matthew.
Yeah, just awkward.
That was pretty big. All right. So the non-Worf thing that I want to ask you about is I was just thinking about how in Deep Space Nine, we deal with time so much. We deal with linear time with the prophets, and especially Sisko is caught up in this idea of whether time is linear or not linear and what that means. And in Generations, we have the Nexus. And in the Nexus, time has no meaning, and it's not linear. You can go to any point in time you want, any time that you want. Do you feel like this idea of the Nexus and the portrayal of time in Generations is more akin to DS9's sensibilities than TNG's? Because this is being written... So Generations was written alongside All Good Things. So Brannon Braga and Ronald D. Moore were writing these together at the same time, and they both deal with time. And it was also happening when DS9 was already well underway, and it deals with time as well. So when I look at the storyline of this movie, it feels like it was written within the age of DS9 rather than the age of TNG prior to the last season of TNG.
It's a really great and interesting concept, the idea of this Nexus that allows you to exist forever in a place where time doesn't exist, and you can do anything and everything that your little heart desires forever. It almost seems like a heaven, and until of course you realize that there's actually no reality to it. It's almost as if you just live in a fantasy forever, and that is a really interesting idea because, like you said, Deep Space Nine is going to deal very specifically with the idea of what it means to be a part of time and not a part of time and outside of time. And this whole idea of being outside of time in the Nexus and then being able to kind of go back into time and whenever you want is a fascinating idea. And I think you're definitely right on when you say it feels like the most Deep Space Nine thing that TNG did up to that point. This really kind of more nebulous idea of time.
Yeah.
And because it's also
not a
maddening
puzzle to solve, right? It's not like All Good Things where it's a puzzle that you just have to solve it, and once you solve it, everything's
right.
Okay.
Right.
It's nebulous. You know, like this energy ribbon has been traveling through the galaxy for who knows how long, and it continues, even after this movie, it continues to travel through the galaxy. The Nexus is not gone just because the movie ends. And that's kind of different from other things that we've experienced.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that I think is really interesting. And I mean, it's a deus ex machina thing for the movie. And it's a bad one in the sense that they use it kind of badly, because if you can go back to any time...
Sure.
Yeah, why didn't you just take Kirk back to, you know, way before this happened so that you can stop Soren and just keep him in custody? You know, well, before the Amargosa Observatory is exploded.
Yeah, go back to the Enterprise B and arrest Soren as soon as they beam him over from the Lakul.
Exactly. Right? But they can't do that because they have to destroy the Enterprise. So this movie has some amazing, ridiculous, awful plot holes.
Yeah.
For contrivance reasons. But the Nexus itself is something that I would have loved to have seen some other time or some other way. I mean, just even the fact that there is an echo of Kirk in the Nexus, does that mean that Echo could leave? How does that work? I mean, there's so much about it that we don't know and so many great questions. But what I love is that this idea of time and the reality and unreality of the existence in the Nexus leads to the action of Kirk. Because Kirk is a man of action and needing to matter. And what I like about that is the way that it connects with Deep Space Nine and the way that Sisko explains time to the prophets. And what we talked about shows back, Chris, about the idea of that is it Sisko's first interaction with them that retroactively to us makes them go back in time, make sure that Sisko is born so that he can be the, you know, all of that to matter, that linear time and what we do matters. And so in that way, yeah, Nexus and time and the way it's dealt with in Generations are much more akin to a Deep Space Nine discussion. And I really like that. So it makes me kind of appreciate Generations just a little bit more than I have before.
Yeah, I like the idea of the Nexus just because of it really makes you think about time and what is time, which is something I've always been fascinated by.
Well, we don't have time to talk about time, Chris, because we just don't have the time. As Darren, if he was here, he would say. So yes, I wanted to say him.
Favorite moments from First Contact, so which we'll talk about next time. Okay, well, any last thoughts on the movie itself? I mean, it doesn't have to tie into DS9, but since we're talking about it, let's just close out with anything else.
You know, even watching it now, Chris, I still have issues with the way that they decided to kill Kirk. I would have much rather Kirk die on the bridge of a starship somehow, that he had been, you know, if somehow Kirk had ended up on the Enterprise D, he, you know, detaches the saucer section and he's on the battle bridge with a couple of people and they're fighting it out with somebody, you know, and he's saving the rest of the crew and giving Picard time, you know, like just something that makes it feel more Kirk-like, because I feel like Kirk he deserved to die on the bridge of the starship, and he would have still died alone because he wouldn't have known any of those people, but it would have been, you know, it would have been Kirk, you know, dying on the Enterprise. That just, to me, that feels so much more right, and I'm surprised that especially Ronald D. Moore hadn't come up with an idea like that, because he's such a fan of the original series and Kirk. Mm-hmm. And we know Ron would change that death if he could. He would do it differently, but they were under time crunch. And so on a whole, though, I felt bad for Picard because he comes off as a real wimp in this film, too. I mean, if you want to have an argument, you know, the argument, who's better, Kirk or Picard? I mean, if you watch this movie, it's Kirk. He beats up Soren. He makes sure that everything can happen. He's the one who, you know, pushes them off the ledge. Picard just keeps getting punched in the face and pushed down a hill. I mean, it's awful for Picard. He looks terrible. But I think the coolest thing about this is for what it does for Picard. Because everybody's like, oh, a movie Picard is different than TNG Picard. Well, you're darn right it is. That's because he came face to face with a legend, and I think his life was changed forever by the conversations mm-hmm. that he had with Kirk. And he yeah. became a little bit more action-oriented. He became more proactive. He became more of that man who wasn't going to be left with an empty house. You know, it was either going to be the Enterprise and him forever, or he would move on and actually have that family we knew he was going to, he wanted, which in the books he has with Beverly now. So I love that. I feel like that conversation changes Picard forever and in a really cool way to make him a little bit more action hero Picard. But it makes sense when you come face to face with the original action hero in the Star Trek universe and yeah. realize that you don't really live up to that action hero.
Well, I think that at that point in time, the characters are portrayed accurately, right? So Kirk does show up Picard here. But Picard in the film is who Picard was on the TV series. So he did what we would expect Picard to do. He negotiated with Kirk in the Nexus. Look, you have to come back. You have to help me. I have to arrange this because I can't do it alone. I need you. And then Kirk is the action guy. We saw it throughout TOS. We saw it throughout the TOS films. Kirk is going to take action. He's going to beat up some aliens if he has to, and he's going to save the day. And I think that's a great point that encounter then changed Picard. That's a good way of looking at it, because if you do think that Picard changes too much in the films, well, maybe there's a reason. You know, we all change over time because of our experiences.
Well, and it's you know, I really do, though, for all of Generations kind of issues, even just plot-wise that we talked about earlier, I do. I love Kirk and Picard coming together. You know, that's the pure fanboyness of it. And having them work together, and I love when Kirk's like, call me Jim, you know? Yeah. And there's just a slight smirk on Picard's face of like, all right, I'm in. You know, like, it's just, it's so... It reminded me about what I loved about Kirk is that, you know, Kirk's a great commander and he was hard on his people to be their best, but he was also kind of this easygoing guy. And I think, again, Picard gets more of that from him as they move on in the films. And that's just really fun. And it leads to Picard being more of who he is in it, like Insurrection and, you know, definitely First Contact. So... It's still a great fanboy thing that those two captains met, and it's kind of cool that the only two captains of the 24th century to meet Kirk are Sisko and Picard. That's pretty sweet. Yep.
And speaking of captains who are hard on their crew and expect a lot, but are easygoing with them as well, Sisko fits that bill.
Yeah, that's very, very true. You know, of all the captains that we get... In Star Trek, you know, I think Sisko has a lot of the Kirk in him. You know, he's more of a fighter. He can be a diplomat if he needs to. And he has a sense of family with his crew that, you know, Picard really had to learn. Sisko, that's more a part of who he is, you know, having his mm-hmm. crew over for dinner, that kind of thing. So, yeah, it's great. I love the way that TNG and Deep Space Nine kind of come together in those ways. And the way that they both, in their own ways, paid homage to the original series that started it all. And what a cool thing to get to talk about, Chris, on you know, the 50th anniversary of Star Trek, the way that it all kind of fits together.
It all fits together, yep. Yeah, for me, this movie, just a few quick final thoughts on it. It is a disjointed movie. We talked about this maybe before we recorded, that it feels like a lot of different ideas kind of smashed together.
Yeah.
But I also really like this movie, and it's often criticized for feeling like a TV episode on the big screen, especially visually. But I like that, and especially when it first came to theaters, I really liked that because We were coming right off the heels of The Next Generation being on television, and being able to see the ship and see the lighting and the way that the ship was shot on the big screen was really beautiful. And being able to see areas of the ship that they couldn't do on a TV budget, like stellar cartography, was great. And just being able to
even
see
the
characters. Well, in the bridge. But being able to see the characters as well was great. You know, we got to see Guinan's candle collection on the big screen, and that was fantastic.
Oh, man. How many times do you think they have to stop by Vulcan every week just to pick up more candles?
That's right. So I think the movie is beautifully shot. I think the lighting is great. I think that it does have a bit of a TV feel to it, but I loved it at the time, and I still like it when I watch it now for that reason. And this movie always has a special place in my heart because it was released around the holidays, and I listen to the soundtrack constantly in my car, and I associate this movie with Christmas. Even to this day, I feel that way, so I really, really enjoy it. But I'm glad that we got to talk about it a little bit, even though it's not Deep Space Nine here on the Orb, because it does kick us off into this exploration of Worf and where he came from, and then how he came onto DS9, and then how the two things work together. So we would love to hear your thoughts on the topic of Worf's journey to DS9. If you'd like to do that, you can do that in the Babel Conference on Facebook. That's probably the best place to have a full-blown discussion. Matthew, tell everyone real quick how to get there.
Well, the Babel Conference is just a fun place, Chris. It's our listeners-only discussion group. It's a private group, which means that you do have to be let in. So if you go to Facebook and you type in Babel into the search field, or you go to any of our show pages and you hit discussion on that menu bar, it'll bring you there. You ask to be let in, we'll let you in. And what opens up is a great new world of fun discussion about Star Trek and everything beyond with the new film, Beyond!
And Beyond.
That's right. And then, of course, with the 602 Club, we're just talking about all things geeky, too. So it's a great place to have a good discussion about all the things that we love, and for the most part, in a very respectful manner. And so I hope you'll come and join us and join in the discussion, especially here, about Worf and his journey to Deep Space Nine, starting with Generations.
Excellent. And if you're not on Facebook, I know not everyone is over there. So there are other ways to get in touch with us. You can send Matthew and me an email. If you go to trek.fm/contact and use the form that you find there, choose to send to a show and choose the Orb, and that'll come to both of us. We're also on Twitter. Our username for the network is trekfm, or you can go to speakpipe.com/trekfm and you can send us a voicemail through there. I'd like to take a moment here to tell you guys about a few other things. First of all, I want to thank our associate producers here on the Orb, Ruth Ward, Will Wynn, and Ken Tripp. Ruth, Will, and Ken help us get this show out to you guys each time, and it's really great that we have their help, because doing the show, doing the network, it's a really big job these days, and it's wonderful that we have people who support us, as Ruth, Will, and Ken do. And you can also find Ken these days on Standard Orbit. You can find Will as the Patreon manager and also previously on Warp 5, but he's still doing the roundtables for us. And then, of course, you can find Ruth there in the Babel Conference. And they all support us through Patreon. Patreon is a way for listeners to help us keep the network going because it costs quite a lot of money to do these shows. And we produce new content every single day. These days, Matthew, it's hard to believe we're producing like about 3 hours on average, I think, of new content every day, 7 days a week.
Chris, it's insane. It's awesome, though.
It is insane. And we don't expect every person to listen to everything we produce. We have all kinds of different shows covering every corner of the Star Trek universe. But to do those, we do need the support of our listeners. So if you're interested in helping out the network, you can find out all about that at patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm. You can get information there about the perks that we have. You can find out how to become an associate producer. You can find out how to be on the round table with Will, get on mic, talk Star Trek with everyone. We put that out through the master feed so everyone can hear it. Also, there are other ways you can become involved in the network. And again, you'll find it all at patreon.com/trekfm. And we thank everyone for your support of the network. Now, Matthew, when you're not contacting the dry cleaner to find out when you're going to get the proper uniform back for the next recording, where can people find you?
Well, Chris, yeah, you can find me on Twitter at MattRushing02. I'm also doing Literary Treks with Dan, where we're talking about the books and the comics of Star Trek, interviewing the authors. We recently had David R. George III on, talking about his latest book, Ascendance, in the Deep Space Nine series. Kirsten Beyer talking about Voyager, so check those out. I do the 602 Club, which is our general geek show. We talk about all things geeky that don't have anything to do with Star Trek, because as we mentioned, Chris, we talk a lot of Star Trek on the network, so this is our one place to sit back, relax, and talk some other things, so I hope you'll join us there. And then, of course, I'm doing a new podcast with John Mills, who's here on the network, on Commentary Trek Stars with Mike Schindler, and we're talking just about Star Wars. Two guys getting together to talk about Star Wars. It's called Aggressive Negotiations. You can find us on iTunes, and of course, we are on our own website at aggressivenegotiations.squarespace.com. Now, Chris, when you're not busy rummaging around the wreck of the Enterprise D, making sure that your cat is safe, where can we find you?
Well, Matthew, once I find the cat and we beam the cat back to safety, you can find me elsewhere on the network doing the Ready Room in one that has not been destroyed by Counselor Troy crashing the ship into Viridian 3. And on the Ready Room, we talk about all five live-action Star Trek series, as well as Star Trek news. We just recorded an episode yesterday, which is a Next Generation episode, and that'll be out next week. And you can also find me doing our daily news show, Hyper Channel. And you can find me doing a non-Star Trek podcast called Metropolis on Air, which is not on the network. It's related to the magazine that I run here in Tokyo. And you can find that on iTunes or at metropolisjapan.com. You can also find my writing about Star Trek on the official website at StarTrek.com. So just go there and search for my name, C. Brian Jones, and that'll come up. And then on Twitter, you can find me under that name, C. Brian Jones, letter C, and Brian with a Y. That's also my name on Facebook and pretty much everywhere. You'll find me in the Babel Conference also. And I'd just love to chat Star Trek with you. So let me know what you think about Worf and all the stuff we talked about here.
We want to thank you for joining us. And we will see you next time as we gaze into the orb.